This is one in a series of podcasts from the Hyatt Webb Conference in Austin, 2011.
I've been at DU. I've been doing content at DU for, I'm working towards 6 years now. And just to kick off, I was kind of interested. I'd love to get a survey and just get a sense of sort of the state of content in higher ed and what you're all doing. So how many of you are, you know, lucky enough to be able to dedicate yourselves full time to working on content? Oh my gosh, that is fantastic. I'm so excited. And how many of you have people on your team, other people that are doing full-time content? Oh my gosh, this is so huge. I bet if you'd asked this 2 years ago, there would have been almost no hands in the air. And then how many of you out there are supermen and are those people who are your one-stop shops and you handle everything yourself? Oh, and I maybe love you even more because with everything that you have to work on and all the skills that you have to have and everything, that you're willing to dedicate the time to come here and talk about content. So bless your hearts, all of you. Oh man, can you help me? I'm off the screen. If someone can come help. Hello. Hi, can you come help me adjust the projector? So I'm starting off talking about what content strategists do, which you can't see. And I'm starting because content strategy has blown up huge in the past couple of years. It really wasn't a thing until 2.5, maybe 3 years ago. And so it's become this huge buzzword. And it's great because people are talking about it, but the one disadvantage to something being a gigantic buzzword is that it can start to lose its meaning or it can start to seem like a fad. And sometimes I hear people talking about it in the Twitterverse or in person, and they talk about content strategists kind of as people who like to talk about leveraging things a lot or synergizing a whole lot. And there's a guy in my field who actually said this, that I guess my dimensions must not be set right, but that when we get really busy, we may not have time to do all that strategy stuff. And those verbal quotation marks were actually really there. And I thought to myself, I laughed to myself for a minute, but then I had to stop and think, like, what a great image of how some people are thinking of content strategy as this set of sort of fussy documents and plans and, you know, and things that you obsess over that actually add a whole lot of time to our projects when we're just trying to get our work done. So if that's one of the impressions that's out there, so what do content strategists actually do? If you're new to the field, or if you're just starting to read the documentation or go to the conferences, you would be forgiven for thinking that they are full-time dedicated to making infographics, because there are a lot of them out there, and some of the most fun, honestly, I had working on this presentation was Googling content strategy and diagrams and seeing what came up, because there's at least 100 different things, and they're pretty, and they're complicated, and there are a lot of arrows and circles. And content strategists get very excited about them. And I don't mean to knock the infographics, because they exist for a very real reason and they serve a purpose. But when you're sort of in higher ed and you're on the ground and you've got to get your projects out the door and your news site's updated and you're maybe arguing with a dean about what your voice and tone on a website is going to be, it could be very easy for these to seem esoteric and like they're not really related to your life. But there's a reason they exist, there really is. And that's because content is complicated. It is, and one of the first things that content strategy acknowledges, openly acknowledges, which I love, is just content is messy, full stop, you know. Content can be painful. And it's a factor of that it includes so many elements of people and processes and skill sets and workflows that it's just always going to be difficult. And it's not because you're doing anything wrong. It's just the nature of the beast. And so all the different ways it can be complicated that we can run into in higher ed, a lot of it's people. You know, we work with people across a lot of different departments. That can be faculty and deans and administrators and any level of staff. And all of that involves personalities you have to deal with and politics that you have to deal with. And people may have entirely different ideas of what the goal of a website is or what makes for an acceptable voice and tone. And so you're negotiating all that. That's even before you get to the content and where it may be coming from and whether, you know, you have faculty trying to write something. We've had front desk staff who 25% of their time was dedicated toward writing content. Some people are outsourcing content. Well, and then there's photographers and videographers, and you're dealing with all of this. You've got all the places you push content out to, and podcasts, email, newsletters. You know, you could go on for ages. Maintenance, how are you going to judge if things are successful? One we deal with a lot is technological limitations. You know, with our resources, sometimes the systems that we have can only do so much to give people the kind of content they want to present, and we have to deal with that. And I literally could go on and on for ages thinking of things. And then there's this big one that we deal with in higher ed, which is that often if you're any kind of essential content person, usually not only are you kind of working your butt off trying to create really good content of your own and maintain it, you're also trying to facilitate other people who have to create content and make them create really great content and maintain it, which is this whole other layer of complexity and teaching and soft people skills and things. Just curious, how many of you, along with creating content, have to deal with other people who are creating their own content? That's what I thought. That's just about everybody. So that's higher ed life for us. So it's good, though, that I'm not here to be intimidating or to give you the sense that there's some huge high mountain that you can't climb to the top of. The fact is, basically, if you're in this room, you're already doing some element of this. If you're getting some kind of content together and you're getting it pushed out and you're getting people to agree on it, you're already doing this Herculean task. It's just that you're doing it kind of intuitively and figuring it out as you go. And I was a content strategist 2 to 3 years before it was a thing. I didn't even know. I was a web editor, and I just figured out that sometimes I just had to do what it took to get stuff done, and I had to wrangle people, and I had to organize huge workflows across all kinds of departments, and it didn't matter, and I didn't think about it that much. I just got it done, and I started to realize that there are certain things that made it easier as I worked from project to project, and that's the heart of what content strategy is. So what strategy does for you, and the reason you should care, is that it takes this very complex, tangled, confused sort of a process that involves people across departments and having to know things and having to organize things, and it starts to pick it apart and untangle it and look at it systematically. So the idea is that it's giving you a sort of consistent set of tools or ways to attack things so that you aren't having to start from scratch every single time and sort of intuitively figure out how you're going to manage things. So it's not about the fussy reports and the leveraging and facilitating and things. It's about giving you a set of tools that actually simplify your life. So how do you take content strategy and how does it simplify your life? To do that, you have to get yourself a process. And not in the sense of like, oh, yeah, when we do content, we talk to this person. I mean, literally, you write down on a piece of paper, bullet out, like, this is exactly what we do, step by step. And this is great for a couple reasons. The first being that when things start going wobbly with the project, which they almost inevitably will in some level, then you have something to refer back to. So when you have this client who comes to you and says, you know, there is no way that we could ever draft content until the pages are built in the CMS, and so we can draft it right there in the CMS. No, this literally happened like a month ago to us. It's a true story. So something like that will always come up, and you can refer back to it. And like, this is our project, this is our process, this is best practices, and this is what we shall do. The other reason is that when you're running multiple projects at the same time, and my team can easily be handling 20, 25 projects that are all churning, and of course, they have different levels of commitment from us and the amount of time we're spending, and they're in different places. But the idea is I could never track across all those projects if I weren't consistently using a process and I were just kind of shooting from the hip all the time. To work, your process has to be flexible, and you want a solid backbone for it, but you need to be able to flex it as you work with different clients. I'm going to walk you through a process that we have and a set of tools that we use, but I'm not at all presenting them as perfect or even as the final product, because pretty much literally every client that we work with, at the end, we stop and think, you know, I just wish if we had asked them that way earlier, it could have saved us a lot of pain and suffering. Or we gave them this tool, but it was too complicated and they had a hard time with it, so maybe we can simplify that. So it's all about adapting, either adapting to the particular project or adapting your process moving forward. And in a sense, to me, that's kind of the ethos of content strategy, is this adaptive learning of a complex sort of process. And maybe the most important thing of all is that whatever process you set up has to truly be realistic, and you have to look clear-eyed at the number of people and the amount of time that you have, because it's so easy to get ambitious coming from a writer-editor background like I do. You think plans are great and shiny, and it's great, and you're going to do all of them. And then you set yourself this entire to-do list, and when it's more than you have time for, that actually weighs you down. It throws stuff onto your to-do list that you can't get done, and it becomes this hassle that you don't need in your life. But if it's a set of tools that's manageable, that you really can slide into your the staff and resources that you have, all of a sudden, it's a boon. It's a tool that's helping you and saving you time. So that's so key. I'm going to talk about our process that our team uses. A disclaimer, this is not any sort of an exhaustive content strategy process. There are a lot of great steps that I'm not going to talk about that you could use, everything from audience analysis to SWOT analysis to governance guidelines. There's all kinds of stuff. But this is intended to be more of a sort of boots in the mud every day. This is what we're using, and this is what, with the minimum amount of buck that we have, the biggest bang that we've been able to get out of it. And secondarily, just about our team. So we, like a lot of us, so we're a central team, and we're in a very, very decentralized organization. So our departments have a ton of autonomy about around their content. And so we work on our own central content that we have a little more control over, but then we also work a lot with clients and, again, try and facilitate in whatever way we can them getting their sites up. And so, because that's where we use the process most heavily and it comes most in handy, I'm going to talk about that a lot, but it also, it's very scalable and it translates to content that you're generating yourself, so you can keep those both in mind as I'm talking. And the tools, I'm going to show you a set of images of these tools that we have. I'm just going to throw up the images so you get a sense of what they're like. But afterwards, I'm going to give you the URL to a site where you can go and download any and all of them that you find helpful. And so no need to try and read them all or write stuff down in a hurry, because they'll all be accessible to you. And this is my one infographic that I have made for you. So soak it up, please. This is as good as it gets. I just wanted you to give you a sense ahead of time what our process looks like that we'll be walking through, because it's kind of big, long, convoluted thing. So we start by prioritizing and sorting the sites we're going to work on before we gather the information we need. And that's all before the actual content production happens. And then we have some post-launch and maintenance work that we do. All right, let's get started. Prioritizing. So we are in higher ed, and all of our lives, this is a reality for us. I work at a mid-sized institution, DU. We've got about 11,000 students, and the umbrella of our website covers somewhere in the hundreds of thousands of pages, depending on who you ask and how they're counting. And we have two full-time central content people, me and a wonderful web editor. And I know how incredibly lucky we are to have two central full-time content people. I know that's relatively unusual. And yet still, with that number of pages, there's, you know, we can't, even a small percentage of that, we can't look at it in any sort of a reasonable detail. So we have to kick off right from the beginning, deciding how many resources we can allocate to a project. And so we have this sort of three-tier system that we created, and it's entirely based on how much the sites map to our institutional priorities. The idea being, if you have this idea for prioritizing things, you get out of that loop of making sites for whoever screams the loudest. So we start with our level one sites that map most closely to our goals. With our institution, and I imagine with most of yours, those goals are incoming students, increasing applications, long-term increasing fundraising, which we try and do through sort of relationship building across alumni and current students. And something we've just started talking about is branding in and of itself being a goal. And so these first tier sites tend to be our academic unit sites most commonly. And with them, we have a very hands-on process where we meet with them, we hold their hands, we explain, we go through processes for them. They generate pretty much all the content themselves, but we work closely together. So one example would be, there's this huge division website we did, academic division, which is natural sciences and mathematics. Level two sites, pretty logically, while they contribute to the goals, it's a lot more indirect. And they may have some, they largely point inside, but they may have some external audiences as well. So again, the process is very scalable, and so they still run through the same process, but we interact with them at certain critical points of it. One of them would be sort of site mapping, and one would be a good content review. But other than that, they're moving through on their own. So an example is student outreach that we did, because that it faces current students, also may have some external facing if prospective students and their parents are doing some deep, deep research. So we want it to be solid, but it's not top tier. In our level three sites, we're working really hard on this process. The long-term goal is that they'll be pretty much entirely self-serve. We want to give them a set of very robust tools and set them up in the beginning, and then mostly they'll go through it on their own. And I have to admit, it kind of hurts my heart as an editor person to know that something's going to get published out there, and I haven't looked at all the words, if you come from print at all, but it's just higher ed life. And you can only do what you do, and if you put too many resources into this, you can't make the top-level sites great. So I've had to give in to that. So these tend to be almost entirely internal-facing sites. Usually they're really small. They wouldn't have to be, but they usually are. Our records management site is a great example. It basically is a list of how you store different records. That's all it was. So we've decided now what level sites hit, and so we know how many resources we're going to allocate to them. And so we do this project kickoff, and we do the same one with everybody. And this is where we need to collect some of the really basic preliminary information. And these are things like why the site needs to exist at all, if they have an even remotely realistic idea of when it should launch, who the stakeholders are, and this is great to find out early on because you get your first ideas of if there's going to be some political weirdness that you're going to have to deal with, and then what they need technically from the site and whether we can even provide that for them. And some of these questions head off problems early on because you may find out this site doesn't need to be. There's no reason. Like, this could be, it could very easily be served by a page on someone else's site. Or they want some sort of functionality that actually some sort of external tool, maybe social media, already provides that we couldn't and shouldn't rebuild for them. So this is what we do with everybody. This is the first tool that you're going to be able to download later, if you like. This is a Word document that we give to everyone, and they just fill in the blanks, and they post it back. We use Yammer as a collaborative tool for every project that we work on. And if you're not familiar with it, Yammer is a social media tool specifically for the workplace. And for my clients who are a little nervous about it, I call it Facebook for Work because it functions very similarly. And you write posts and you can upload documents. And it's a great space for us because you create these private groups nobody else can see. And one, you can track the whole conversation across the timeline. But also, documents like this will always be there to refer back to. So say our developers are working on the site, they can look back at this point and see what the directory needs to be named and whether they need redirects, things like that. Once that's finished for everybody, here, especially with the top tier sites, we get into where content and IA start kicking in together. So this is the next part of gathering information. It's more in depth, but it applies both to content and IA. So what we do is we sit down with them personally with a set of questions. We don't give this to them to fill out. And that's because the questions are more complicated and contextual, and sometimes you need to ask a follow-up question or word things differently to get to the information that you really want. The kind of information we're getting here are things like, more specifically, what are the goals of the site? Really, what's it going to do? What are the tasks that your users need to complete? What are the problems it's going to solve for your department? And we've started at this point just brainstorming metrics, throwing them out there for things that might possibly measure whether the goals are being met. And I really like doing it this early, partly because, you know, it gets the seed in their minds right away that they're going to be measuring this after launch. And also, maybe this is just me being idealistic, but I like to think that it shapes the way that they're thinking about content, in that all the pieces that they're working on are going to need to do something very specific. So they need to write it in the sense of whether it's going to accomplish a goal for them, not just to be, you know, spewing stuff out there. We cover the branding and key messages at this point. We make sure they have them and that they fit into the university's branding hierarchy and that they're compatible. It's a great time to find out really realistically what kind of staff they have to work on their sites, because I'm going to harp on maintenance in this presentation, because I feel like it's one of the biggest problems I see, not just in DU, but I think across higher ed, is outdated content. Because how often do you go to an academic unit's website and it says upcoming events, the most recent one is 3 months ago? Or how often do you go to a news site and the most recent news event is 9 months ago? And I just feel like that's so detrimental to your brand and really says something about how much the organization cares about communicating. And so I try and do a lot of things to make sure that that out-of-date content doesn't happen. So here, we're going to find out realistically how many people can help create the content, and as well as how many people can help maintain the content. And we keep that in mind. So we've established all this. We are getting on to IA. We have a user experience designer, and he works on building the sitemaps. With the top-level programs, he'll create the first version of the sitemap, and then they go back and forth, and they refine it. With the second-level sites, it's more likely that he'll give them a tool, and they build their own sitemaps. And then, again, there may be some back and forth while we refine it, and we make sure that those actually work. So the UX designer owns this part of the process, but content still does have a role. And so we keep an eye on this so that we keep an eye on the labels, what's going on in the navigation, to make sure that the language is, you know, it's a real human being language, and also that it doesn't have some sort of funky connotations that can sometimes sneak in when non-content people aren't thinking about it. And this is also our time to head off some content weirdness before it gets baked right into the sitemap and becomes a lot harder to deal with later. So that's things like content that isn't there. And sometimes that's because the client never thought of it in the first place. Sometimes it's something awesome that we know that we can do that they may not have thought of, so we can bring that up. It's a great time to avoid needy content. Again, that's that keeping your content up to date kind of thing. Because everybody, really, they get enthusiastic about their site, and they think it's so fantastic that they'll update a profile of a student on their homepage every single day. And if we can try and think, someone really going to collect that information and write that and make those changes? If not, maybe we can head that off right here. Unnecessary content. This is a great time to catch that old bear of we have it, so we're going to stick it online because we have it, and we've always had it online. So anything like my constant battle is I would love to see the end of the letter from the dean. Thank you. If there's any way I can make that happen. Well, that's an idea, but then you still have to get the dean to accept not having it on their website. It's this very... something we can propose. What we're right now, it's just accepted, and everybody has it across all their sites. We're trying to work with... The best I can do right now is, all right, post-launch, we're going to look at this in a few months, and we're going to see what kind of hits you're getting on this. Maybe when two people have hit it, maybe they'll acknowledge that it's kind of useless. But we also have things where, they have calendars from academic programs from 2 years ago because someone might want to see what the calendar was 2 years ago. And so, anyway, this is where we can head off some of that unnecessary content. Sitemap signed off on. This is where content really gets into it. And we first start with meeting with people, and we talk to them about the process first before we even get into the writing for the web side of things. And obviously with the first tier clients, we do this much more in depth. With a second tier, it might be sort of an email conversation or a quick conversation or something. The reason it can be an in-depth conversation is because workflows are going to vary a great deal depending on what's going on in the departments. And this is where some of that sort of human knowledge kind of stuff can kick in, because you may be dealing with a department, which truly happened recently, where they say the first draft has to be written by a committee of 20 people. It's the only way it can be done, and we have no choice. Or they may be outsourcing writing to somebody, a pro, so you never know. So this is where we have to sort of debrief them and find out what's going on about who will get their information and write it, edit it, approve it. And this is a great time when we start to get... we find out about some of that weirdness, whether it's they talk about maybe somebody's going to be editing things, but personality-wise, they're difficult. Or somebody's going to be approving things, but she is notorious for missing her deadlines. And so then we're like, well, truly, give her a deadline that's 2 weeks ahead of when her real deadline is. And we can help them work through some of that and be set up to work. This is the point where we give them one contact person that works with us. They just get one, because we've been in a situation in the past where I was working with an academic department where a faculty member had very strong feelings about how one section of the site should function, and their director of communications had very strong other feelings about how that site should function. And it came to me to mediate that somehow. And when you're not even in that department, it's nearly impossible. So they don't get to do that anymore. One person goes through all of that and funnels the resultant content to us. We'll talk to them about what's going on if they're having a hard time, but we're not going to negotiate the problems. So once they have the workflow filled out, we map it onto the content inventory. And oh my gosh, do I love the content inventory. This is my favorite web invention since the beginning of time. And so we give everyone a sample of an inventory, and we move it onto them to fill out. With our top tier clients, we might fill out more of it. But the idea is they get an example of how to do it. We just use a simple Excel spreadsheet, and every page gets a row, and every column tracks some piece of information about that page. And I love using a laser pointer. I don't get to do this enough in my life. But everywhere, so they start by talking about the unique page ID for every page. A UX designer, when he creates the sitemap, he already gives, you know, every page gets its unique ID. So it's very simple for them to fill it in, and it's a way for them to really track every single page that they're going to need. Then everybody tracks basically, you know, what it'll be called, a basic idea of what they might need from that content, and then they all track their photos, for example. When you move a little farther on in the spreadsheet, depending on what their workflow is, there may be all kinds of different things they need to track. If they have, maybe different people are writing things, and then they need to track who, but maybe not. Maybe they don't need that column. Maybe multiple chunks are going to be going through approval, so maybe they need to track that. And so you can invent all the columns you want. But everybody has this maintenance section right there. And here's where they track how often it needs to be updated and exactly what it is. And my goal is that everything goes up there. If there's a page that has a date on it, that it goes up there. And so they know they have to go back to it later. And again, one, this is great for post-launch when they have to maintain things. The other reason it's great is because they're thinking about it as they're writing this content. They're thinking about how frequently they're really going to have to update this and if they can manage it. Another tool we get them is we call it a page template. Content strategists call things vaguely different names, but just stick with content page template for us. It's a Word document that we give them, and it's basically a series of blanks for them to fill in. And so for every page of content that they write, we ask them to stick it in this page template. This is the only way I have found to make sure that everybody has keywords and descriptions for every page when they go in to enter it in the CMS. We even ask them about alt tags, because the CMS is going to force them to put in an alt tag when it's time to enter the content, so they're going to need it. And our pages have, you can't read this, but our pages have an optional write rail, and usually it's a persistent piece of content with contact information across all our pages, but this is a reminder to them that they can switch that up and they can stick banners in and things like that, and this is a reminder to them to be thinking about this, which they often wouldn't be otherwise. We also give them just a few general content tips, which I love and I thought y'all might find useful as well. The first is to break up sites into sections and never try and take on the whole thing as a block, partly because that gets pretty intimidating and people sort of give up by the end, but partly because time-wise, it's so much more efficient than having one person writing a whole website and everybody else is doing nothing. And then it moves on and one person's doing all the editing. Instead, one person does a section and that turns on to editing or approving while they're writing the next section, and it's a lot more functional. The thing is, I could never imagine doing that without a content inventory. It would get way too crazy, especially with a big site. So those two kind of go together. I love this one. I came up with this one. It's that every page is a Word document. And so we ask them at the beginning of the Word document to start it with the page identifier for that page. And this is great because once you get it all in one folder, all the pages are in order, and you can sort of read through them in order of the page outline, the site outline, or even better when the when you can line them up against the content inventory, and you can line up one column against the folder, and you track across, and you know automatically that you have every page. Another cool one is when you go to talk to your subject matter experts for your site. Often this is faculty members. It could be administrators or anyone, but often it's faculty. Don't go to them and ask them to write three pages for your website. Instead, just sit down with them and ask them questions and write down their answers. And it's great for a couple reasons, one of which is when they're verbally telling you something that they know, they're going to talk like a human being, and they're going to use that human being language that you can take and put straight into your site, because that's what's going to be very readable for the web. Another reason is it's going to save you a lot of time in that if they are going to sit there and compose pages and try to make them perfect, they're going to spend a lot of time doing that you're going to have to wait on. And also, if they do that and spend a lot of time making their pages perfect, they're going to be really resistant to giving it back to you and having you edit it for the web, and you're going to have a battle there. So you can avoid all of that by just, it seems like it might take longer to write it yourself, but in the long run, much, much faster. All right, so we've walked them through how the process is going to work for them. Now we get to actually how they're going to write for the web. It's one of the hardest things that we deal with, and I'm constantly thinking on this and trying to make it better. Reason why is that good content is incredibly hard. And I've been doing content in one form or another for my whole adult working life. And I still struggle with how do I write something so that's really task-focused, that's really user-focused, but it also communicates our brand messages in the way that we want to. It can be an art form. So you're asking people to buy into that sort of thinking and working that hard on their content. Also, I'm sure we've all run into our voice and tone. Academia does not like a simple voice and tone, and they think it sounds dumbed down. Well, I think it makes you sound like a really good communicator. So you're, so there's that clash all the time. And I'm telling you, almost every time, they're just going to want to cut and paste the content from the current site without looking at it, because their site works perfectly fine. So why are you coming to me and telling me I'm supposed to spend all this time messing with something that already works? So these are the challenges you're facing. One of the most successful ways that we've found to teach people on how to write for the web is this seminar. We've tried one-on-one conversation. We've tried Word documents to hand out. And this is the one thing I've seen people really respond to. It's just a presentation that I did. I used to do it live all the time, either one-on-one with clients, or I'd set up cross-campus ones every now and then. And close to the start, I show them, the heat maps, the eye tracking maps, and people, somehow that really clicks for them when I can show them, not just look at how the eye's skipping around the page, but look at those whole big lands of blue right there that nobody is reading, and how long did you spend writing that whole big vast wasteland of blue? And seeing that, I start there, and then from there I move on and talk about all the ways that applies to writing. But this gets me some buy-in, and I just recently, it occurred to us that why not just record this and put it online so I don't have to be doing it in person all the time. So we just threw it up on YouTube as screenshots with my voice over it, and so you'll get a link to that if you find it helpful. But I had one guy come to me after this presentation and say, I saw your presentation and I just realized I have to rewrite every page on my website. And it just gave me like the warm fuzzies, like I could not believe, like I had a reason to exist and I'd accomplished something. So this has been a great tool for us. We give everybody a style guide, and that is just, there's an institutional style guide which covers the all the basic institutional terms that need to be common. But then this is a real quick thing. It's a few pages, and it just addresses the style issues that only come up on the web or that come up all the time on the web. So there's a few things like, here's how you spell the word, here's how you write the word email. The words click here shall never be a link, ever. And we shall not put up any pages that say under construction, ever. That's not allowed. That we will wait and we'll put the pages up once the data is actually there. This is a relatively quick tool you could implement if you don't have a lot of time. And it Even the little things like having phone numbers always displayed the same way across your site, they're small, but when people are skimming through, it gives the sense that, you know, you're consistent and you know what you're doing and you're a professional organization. So this little thing could get you some mileage if you really get people to use it. Not too long ago, we started using content models. And this is, we found certain types of content are going to be repeated across many sites on our website. So far, we've just started, so we're just talking about academic units. And so far, we've done one for faculty profiles and for degree program descriptions. So those are the most common things we're finding. I think over time, we may do more. So the idea here is, rather than asking all these clients to go and sort of from scratch figure out how to write these very marketing intensive pages, why not give them an example that we already know that is written in terms of users' interest and things like that? So here for the faculty profile pages, you know, we try and start out with the sort of research they're doing, which prospective students care about, rather with starting where they got their BA, which with a lot of people will tend to do. And so we basically just give them these holes that they need to fill in, and this red text calls out some kind of content that is very interesting. That would be great to have, but it does require updating. So if you can't invest that amount of time, don't use it. So we've given them all the tools. We've learned that the fact is that we just walk into a room and tell them, you know what, your content is terrible, and it always has been terrible, and we're going to tell you how to not make it terrible. You're going to get sort of limited buy-in when you do that. And so I've learned you really do try and have to be the jumping, cheering cheerleader as much as you can and get them really excited about doing it themselves. The couple of big successes I've had were people that, you know, we talked to them enough that they got excited and wanted to invest the amount of time that you have to invest to do content well. And so rather than walking in there as lecturers, we try to walk in there as their best friends and tell them, you know, find out what their pain points are. And that's one of the questions we asked back in the Q&A about IA and content. You know, where are your problems? And your problem is, yeah, all these people get to our apply section, but then they're not filling out the application form. Well, let me tell you, if your content did this, you could up those numbers a lot, and then they'll get much more excited about it. So they've produced all their content, and now we get to the point of editing it. And it may, depending on the site, it may come to our department for edits. Most of them do to some extent, except for maybe the lowest tier ones. And here's the point where you just really, really have to prioritize because you can't edit all the pages. Even in our highest level sites, we found that we can't like closely line edit all the pages, even in our big academic units. And with them, we closely edit the top level pages, and we may even write some of their top level marketing pages. But when we get down to some of the really bottom informational pages, we try and find, you know, you often find a set of consistent sort of problems, and so we write them up a notes page. And these are the kinds of problems you can fix. You can break up your paragraphs, you can put subheads here. Avoid these really general, huge marketing terms and replace them with specific proof points. For example, here are some proof points from your organization. And then the onus is on the client to actually go and apply those to their content. But hopefully we've got them excited enough and cheery enough that they really want to do that. As much as possible, we try and do a final proof of everything before it goes into the content entry phase. Just a real quick one in the sense of looking for huge glaring problems or under construction pages or, you know, 8 months out of date content, things like that. And to make sure that all the content is there, because our CMS training goes insane when people get there and they just don't have content for a page. So we've gotten through content, and then this is the process. Our whole web team has its own, you know, process that content is only a part of. And we design and develop. Everybody does a QA before launch to look for problems, and then launch. And everybody's excited, and the client's very excited, and happy emails are sent back and forth. So the client often tends to think they're done at this point. But what content strategy brings here, one of our strengths is that, you know, you have launched this fragile, young, green website out into the world, and it can't stand on its own. It's going to wither and die if you don't continue to interact with it. So we have sort of a post-launch conversation about how this is going to be maintained. And with our highest level clients, that's a meeting where we sit down and chat. With others, it may just be an email, but the idea is to impress upon them that their site has a life cycle, that it's not just launch and leave. So looking back at the information we had them put in their content inventory, we set a very specific schedule for when they're going to do updates. And we show them how to set up automatic reminders for themselves. And our CMS allows you to set a reminder for every page if you want. It will email you and tell you when that page needs to be updated. If your CMS doesn't have that functionality, Outlook reminders can function just as well. The idea is to have something automatically telling you when you need to do updates. And we also talk about how our goal is that every site, every page is read at least once a year, because there's content that may not have a date in it, but it can over time sort of become subtly irrelevant or sort of gradually out of date. And we just don't want to get into that stage where on a big site there are pages that you haven't read in 3 years. So we're trying to make this a policy for everyone. And we talk about measurement. And this is something that I think has been underutilized, not just with us, but across higher ed in general. And so we decide on a specific set of metrics out of the ones that we brainstormed earlier in the process, and we make sure that they're tied very closely to the specific goals that they talked about. And the most common ones will be based on analytics, but you can be creative, and sometimes analytics, there may be solutions otherwhere. For example, if their big goal is we want people to be able to find this information on their website, maybe you measure how often your front desk staff is answering questions from people looking for information that's on your website. So you can think about real world, just what is it that really determines whether your site is doing what you want it to. So we've learned that these metrics need to be specific enough that you really can act upon them, because every academic unit that you talk to, their goal is going to be to increase applications. It's always going to happen, which is great, and it's what they want. But so many factors go into that, both on the site and off the site, that if application numbers go down, what's the thing that you go and fix on the site? There's no way to pick that apart. So instead, we try to look for things that are so specific that they can tell you what needs to be fixed. For example, look at this page, and is this page sending people to apply the way that you want it to? Or this whole series, you know, set of pages, where are they sending people? And that way, they can look at those pages and try tweaking things, and then try, measuring it again. So the idea is we walk away from this where they have a set of metrics that they're going to measure. On the very highest level sites, we may actually measure some of them ourselves so we can judge the impact that we've had. But mostly, the onus is on the clients here, too. So here we go. I've walked you through the whole process and given you the set of tools. These are all of them. My goal here is for you guys to go home and to pick something and start using it on Thursday. And just maybe pick one thing and think about what your pain point is and what is driving you insane, whether that's trying to track tons of documents all at the same time, or whether it's, you know, arguing with somebody about what voice and tone is actually reasonable for their website. So I challenge you to go and download one of these and change it and modify it and make it work better or make it work for your specific situation, and I would love that. Here's your website, du.edu/ucom/highedweb.html. And of course, the presentation will be online and you can find it there, but I'll also tweet this URL on TNT6 afterwards so you can find it there. And there you go. And also, please contact me. I love that. I geek out about this stuff all day long, and so I love to hear what other people are doing and what's working better than what I'm doing already. And so just come and talk to me. Thank you. Yes?
Can you run through your staff and what their roles are?
Sure. So on our team, we have, there's a director of our team managing us, and then we have our user experience designer, who covers design and IA, basically, and two developers, and then two content people, so me and Valerie. And between the two of us, we can do a lot of the same work in the sense that when we need to, we both end up editing content and things, but essentially, I try and look at it more strategically, and I build processes and I build tools like this, and I do maybe more of the people wrangling than she necessarily does, and then she'll work on more of the kind of simpler projects. Not that there's not always people wrangling with those as well. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, you know, super developed or advanced how we've done it just yet. I mean, really, we're sitting at the table and we're like, well, what are some possible ways that maybe we could measure this? And generally, they don't throw anything out at first, but we say something like, well, what if a lot of people come, from this page, get to the right page? What if your goal is getting more people to your site in the first place, what we could maybe look at organic organic referrals from search engines. And so often they won't maybe have the web know-how to say exactly what the numbers are, but they can sort of get what we're saying and say, well, it's really more important that our current students are finding this. And so we can try and figure out what metric that could possibly be. So yeah, we try and throw it out for just ideas and put it on Yammer and say, keep on adding to this conversation as more ideas come up for what you can do. And so it's still a challenging one, but we're working on it. Yes?
Do you or your team receive the same notifications about the update intervals, the reminders, so that you know whether they're, how do you police whether or not they're supposed to
do? So policing or governance is a tricky one. In most cases, I mean, in theory, we would have this whole set of rules and the authority to go in and make sure people do these things. And partly because we don't really have the authority and partly because we haven't really had the time to check up on people, we really haven't been doing that too much. We spot check when we can. We really generally won't follow up to make sure that people update things, except for if there's some really important sites and important things that we need to make sure, then we for the same page, they could set themselves a reminder and we could as well. So then we could go and check on that. Right.
Very nice, Kate. Thank you.
Thank you.